This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We have two men to fill this 1 hour, and they are two very different poets, and two poets you will not forget in a hurry. Here is the voice of Kwame Alexander.
She tells me they only sell books about social justice and peace, and that mine are mostly about love and relationships, which they don't promote. I ask her if she thought changing the world by herself was such a good idea, and how could you ever be free without someone to hold? I wonder how many revolutions started with a kiss, how many communist Neruda made love to, how free it must feel to walk through life at peace, alone.
That is the voice of Kwame Alexander. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. Kwame's a poet, a publisher, and an award-winning producer of literary programs. He has been dubbed a phenom, I like that, in the poetry world by the Charleston, South Carolina City Paper. He's written for television, stage, and authored, edited 10 books, including a young adult title, Crush, Love Poems, and Family Pictures, Poems and Photographs, Celebrating Family, that is just out this year. Mm-hmm. Kwame, welcome to the Library of Congress.
Oh, such a pleasure to be here with you, Grace.
Kwame, your work, I was at Georgetown yesterday, and the student said to me, is your poetry political? And I'm going to ask you what you think political poetry is.
Well, I think anytime, you're living in America, especially at this particular time, as a responsible artist, anything you write is political. More specifically, as an African-American living in America since the arrival of the first slaves, most everything you write is political because you're writing from a vantage point of trying to understand this society that hasn't necessarily viewed you in the best light and trying to understand it and be able to live in it. And as Derrick Bell, the former Harvard professor, said in his book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, he believes that racism isn't ever going anywhere. You can't change it, but you have to constantly fight against it just to remain sane. So I think as a poet, as a writer, that's why I write. I try to remain sane, Grace.
And what you come out with is a beautiful residue. Don't find much overt anger in your work.
Well, that's that's interesting you say that because in college, when I was studying, I had this amazing professor, Nikki Giovanni. And well, that's one of the things she used to say, Kwame, your poetry is so angry. It's so angry. And I wrote all these, you know, I was very angry at apartheid. I was very angry at the fact that we didn't have a black studies program at Virginia Tech. So I was very angry. And she said, well, you know, stop writing about the outside. Write about what's in. Look at it from what's in. Look at it from the context of how you're feeling and not just necessarily what you're thinking
about. What good
about.
Advice.
Oh, my God. And it just changed. I didn't necessarily take it. Okay. I didn't take it at the time. But over the years, I started thinking about
it. And
that.
We're going to prove it to the world right now with another poem by Kwame Alexander.
Well, you know, poetry, people often ask, well, how'd you start writing? And it was, and I can remember the exact moment, Grace. I was age 12 and I'd written this poem. I didn't have a whole lot of money for Mother's Day, so I'd written a poem for my mom. It was the first poem I wrote, typed it up on our IBM Selectric typewriter, put it in this gold-plated frame, and gave it to her. And she just cried. She teared, you know, these tears of joy. And I, at that point, I said, wow, if I can have this kind of effect on women with poems, maybe that's something I ought to do more of. But no, you know, seriously, my mother introduced us, you know, to writing. And this is a haiku that I wrote for her that's in Family Pictures. There would be no poems without the childhood joy, the playful way you loved. At any given moment, Grace, my mother could break out into a story, an African myth. She would read a poem to us. We had a house full of literature and love, and I think that's, you know, really where it started for me.
Kwame, you didn't stand a chance. Not being a poet.
I didn't.
You didn't stand a chance.
I really didn't.
So your passion for family started in the kitchen, and it is resulting, I'm holding in my hand this beautiful compendium. It's called Family Pictures. Just out this year, it is physically beautiful. We will talk about how he got the idea, whatever got into him to think he could do it, and what we have in the result. But more, we would like your poetry again. This is Kwame Alexander. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're celebrating Kwame.
Well, Family Pictures, thanks for mentioning that book. It was a labor of love, and I come from a family, a pretty large family. My father was a minister, a PhD from Columbia, a member of the Black Arts Movement, a cosmetologist, certified cosmetologist, a bibliophile, a college professor, a publisher, an author of 16 books. So he did it all. And so when I think back on family, I remember asking myself as I got older, Grace, how did I know this man loved me? Because he never said it. He wasn't that kind of man. He never spoke it. And so this is sort of a piece that I wrote once I figured out the way that I knew that. Acts of love. You never know he loves you. You overhear that he works like a slave and that freedom is expensive, so you pay the price. There are no hot dogs and soda pop summers because there are no baseball games. Your tongue is not sweet on cotton candy because there are no moonlit carnivals. Time is money. Smiles are seldom. Home is serious business with little time for little things like card games and ping pong and talking. Conversations become instructions. Write all messages here. Clean the gutters as such. Mow the lawn like this. You crave his touch. Some small ritual of precious contact. Perhaps a drop of water in noonday heat. Even a forehead scratch would do. You never know he loves you. You overhear that he works like a slave and that freedom is expensive, so you pay the price. Mm. Family meetings become trials. Who took this message? Guilty. Why isn't the grass cut? Guilty. Did you finish up on the roof? Guilty. You never hear he loves you, even in the car, engine battling the hum of silence, questions you're afraid to ask. Then one day, in your Sunday proper, his sermon ended, the pews empty. You shadow his stillness, hoping for some movement on this desert island. You look up into blinding sun. Sweat clings to high mountain. His face, a golden moon, now beams. His hands, spring rain, drizzling scalp. And then you know. And so every Sunday at the end of church, he'd come down out of the pulpit, and with his right hand, he'd shake the congregation's hand as they walked up, and with his left, he'd massage my scalp. Happened every Sunday.
Kwame conducts poetry and publishing workshops in schools and conferences, and he lives here in Washington. He produced the annual Capitol Book Fest, presented by the Washington Post. And he's currently president of a Book a Day literacy program that teaches and inspires young people in writing and publishing. And his work papers can be found at the George Washington University Gelman Library. What is the Capitol Book Fest?
Capitol Book Fest is more than a notion, Grace. It was an idea that I had about 4 years ago to put on a book festival in Prince George's County, Maryland.
So you started it?
Yeah, I started it. And had some great, you know, people who've worked with me to make it happen. And the Washington Post came on board as a presenting sponsor. So this was it's the first Saturday in October. This past October the 6th was the third annual. We try to feature 75 to 100 authors, primarily from the D.C. metro area. But we bring in some, you know, celebrities, some nationally known authors.
Where do you get the loot?
Wow.
Who
have some
funds
great...
It?
Well, you know, if we were living in England, you know, we'd have sort of an arts council grant maybe to make this happen. You get a lot of funding over there. But I got to say, the community organizations, the businesses in Prince George's County, they came through, Grace. Whether you're talking about, you know, the Prince George's County Housing and Urban Development or the Washington Post.
You went to each one of them and knocked on the door?
And knocked on the door. And they all opened it and gave us checks and made it happen. Because there's a big push for literacy. People want to see kids reading and writing. And the big theme, you know, we're getting back to family. The big theme, Grace, for the Capitol Book Fest is strengthening families through reading. And we propose that if you immerse yourself in reading, if you begin to understand how to write and you begin to enjoy literature, everything else achieves. Grace, these are not times for poets. Iambic pentameters will not wake up the job market. alliteration cannot convince corporate capitalists to consider your competence. Metaphors will not move the sun, and you won't own the night or your house. Even your unrhymed haiku are longer than the next temp assignment because the only full-time jobs are in the Army Reserves for the hopeless young forced to star in the latest reality show, Who Wants to Die? These are not times for poets. Stock options are not available for builders of words. 401ks do not exist for literary photographers of pain and hope. There are no benefits for those of us who tell the truth about unfair housing and Enron and secondhand smoke and other reasons to riot. These are not times for poets. Healthcare is not covered under the starving artist plan. Try not to smile in front of others, especially on interviews, because dentists don't accept concise wordplay as payment. And yes, God is good and Jesus loves you, but hospitals get real inhospitable if your cross ain't blue. These are not times for poets. There are no six-figure advances for singers of sonnets and sestinas. There are no Best Picture awards for your moving words. No Dave Chappelle money for your witty canto. Hollywood has closed its door to free verse because good cost, and it's cheaper to stare blankly into the coffers of mediocrity. These are not times for poets who wander without tradition, who fight without armor. These are not times for poets whose pages are filled with latchkey words and blank vision. These are not times for poets that race around tenured tracks, click in tow, who publish and perish because nobody reads their poems, not even their own mamas. These are times for poets who love freedom more than they love applause. Calling all strong poets, whose words exercise, whose stanzas bench press our burdens, whose poems lift the weight off our world and put it in a better place. Caution, I have seen these hardworking poets and they don't come cheap. Men and women whose monsoon voices ooze honesty, scream sheets of soul so cool, so loud, so unflinchingly fearless, they make a living out of rhythm, can turn line breaks into wine, will wrap their tongue around the current political landscape so deftly, make you want to spread democracy around the globe. They can change the world. I have seen these poets, committed men and women, and they are available for work, real work, the kind of work these times call for. I think we need poets. What's the future for poets? The White House needs a poet. Bush needs two black poets. MSNBC needs a poet. There should be a poet everywhere because poets are what connect memory, the future. You know, poets are what, it's the human connection. And that's what we're lacking. We talk about, you know, library 2.0, web 2.0, classroom 2.0. You know, we need poetry 2.0, Grace. We need to connect
Kwame
people.
Kwame Alexander, you are listening, world. Tune in. Kwame Alexander is telling you how it really, really is. And we do need poets in the White House, and we need them in every venue.
Well, I remember, Grace, doing a workshop for some students, middle school students, and was talking about poetry, and there was this one kid, eighth grader, named Adam. And I asked the students to define poetry. Give me a definition. And Adam says, poetry is, he just looked at me and he said, poetry is a get together of emotions. A little eighth grader. And I said, wow, can't you just see that? You know, words getting together, words partying, you know, throwing a festive, you know, sort of party. And yeah, that was a very inspiring.
They teach you a lot, right?
Yeah, they do.
Those kids, they teach you a lot.
And I have a 16-year-old who teaches me a whole lot, and she wants to start dating. And so this is a poem I wrote for her. It's called The Examination. And I asked her, I said, well, before you start dating anyone, I need to meet their parents. And that's the first thing.
Really?
Yeah. I'm old school, Grace.
You need to meet the parents of your daughter's date? Just
yeah.
For a date?
Oh,
the
yeah.
Senior prom?
Nope, got to meet them. And the second thing I did was, you're looking at me like I'm crazy, but
well,
hey.
She'll never let you.
Well, no, I did it.
Okay, let's hear it.
I did it. The second thing is I asked her, have you given him the test yet? Before you go out with any boy, have you given him the test? And she said, what test? Here's the test. It's called The Examination. Can you study my heart and learn to love me with your mind? Can you lift my spirits, exercise my intellect? Can you get deep like Atlantis, precise like Google, outstanding like a Serena Williams serve? Can you love me like a book of poetry? Read me over and over, uncover the magic between my lines. Can you solve me like a quadratic equation? Recite Neruda in Spanish. Forget sexy. Can you bring smart back? Can you flirt with me? like an E. Ethelbert Miller poem. Tease me like a bossa nova song. Can you sweet talk me with cotton candy on a rainy day? Love me like Nikki Giovanni loves Tupac. Can you speak to me with your mouth closed? Can you kiss me 100 times with your eyes open? Can you love me with your mind?
Kwame, how many people can pass that test?
Not a whole lot, right? That's the trick.
But that would be fine for marrying somebody, but not for the sock hop.
Now, in my house, yeah, it's got to be, they got to pass the test. And yeah, the test may not be that stringent, but we got to start somewhere.
The integrity of Kwame Alexander reaches from the page to his daughter's ponytail. Here he is. I'm Grace Cavalieri with the Library of Congress. How hard was it for you to put together this book, Family Pictures? Just tell me from the beginning, you woke up one morning and you had an idea, then you got up and got dressed, and what did you do next to fulfill this mission?
Well, first of all, I looked at my wife and I said, honey, I really want to do this book. And she said, what? A coffee table book with photos? You know how expensive that's going to be? Mm-hmm. And so I had to pitch her. I had to sell her on it first. And so she bought it. She thought it was a great idea. We put out the word. First, we had to gather poems. We wanted about 100 poems in the book. So we put out a submissions.
On email.
On email. Mm-hmm. That was it, on email. Mm-hmm. Made a couple calls to some friends. And we got about 700 responses, Grace, from around the world. From Europe, from Africa, quite a few from Africa, all over the country. And then from there, I took it and, you know, really read through and tried to figure out which ones were going to work for this book. And we got it down to about 70. And then I made a couple of calls to some people I knew I really wanted in the book, like Ethelbert Miller or Lucille Clifton or Nikki Giovanni. And from there, I had about 73 poems that we had chosen for the book. Then I called photographers, people I knew, and said, send me your photos of family. And Grace, I got to tell you, it was a divine experience for me because I then got these photographs from these photographers. They hadn't seen any poems, and I had to match the photographs with the poems.
And it did work.
It worked. Mm-hmm. When I saw some of these poems and how they fit with the photographs, it was just amazing. It was a great experience, and it just happened. So it had to be divine.
And from start to finish, was it a year, would you say, or six months?
It was about a year. Mm-hmm. It was about a year from sending out that first submission till, you know, the time the books came out. The books actually were delivered from the printer October the 1st, and we started in November of 06.
What do you do with the books now?
We gave the books away at the Capitol Book Fest. We gave them away to, like, maybe the first 500 people who came. And now we're selling it.
How? What was the run on this?
1,500. Yeah. We're selling copies now to raise more money for the Capitol Book Fest.
Can you make a living doing this? What if you just were an entrepreneur that fostered poetry and brought capitalism, pardon the expression, into the play, and then you could do good work and they would benefit by this? It hasn't really been done like that on a local level.
Well, I think you can make a living from it. And I think that's always been the goal. And throughout my career, which has easily been, you know, 12 to 15 years, there's been stints where I've been able to make a living at doing it. But I think you have to have integrity for your art, and you have to have an understanding of business and commerce. The most recent book of mine, Crush, which is a young adult title,
Yes. It
just got reviewed in School Library Journal. And after that review, tons of orders have come in, tons of orders. And I think it's very refreshing for an artist to be able to get critical review, to get reviewed positively from one's peers. But also, it's important to be able to pay the bills, Grace.
Also, that age group is forgotten.
Right.
The young adult age group is totally the one sought after by publishers.
Exactly.
And would you call that the, not the 8 to 12, but the 12 to 15 or 8 to 15?
I would call it maybe the 12 to 16.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is the, that's the arid area in literature.
Definitely.
Okay. Let's hear more of Kwame. And if I were going to ask you, before you read, if you think literature can be separated from life, yes or no?
If literature can be separated from life,
Can we write literature that is different from our life?
Well, I think you can expand upon life. You have to start with life, though.
Okay, let's hear life.
Life is the beginning. You want to hear life? Okay. This is life at work, Grace. Memo to company president. Today, let us toast. I have decided to ask for a pay decrease. I know it sounds strange, but I no longer want that promotion or the vacant office. Sick leave, pointless. My cabinets are well stocked with echinacea. Plus, I want to be a team player. In fact, I am returning my comp time. From now on, I will work weekends for free. There were no bonuses last year for us, but do know that theoretically, I am giving that back too. You see, I now realize that it would be healthier if I were miserable on purpose.
Oh, Kwame, I want it on the back of every bus.
I now realize that it would be healthier if I were miserable on purpose rather than continue working in earnest while corporate greed and calculated lies shatter your pledge of loyalty.
That is the best thing I've heard on Commerce this year. Yeah. That is great. Now we know who your villains are. Who are your heroes and heroines?
Wow, heroes and heroines. It's very close. It's held very close. My family, you know, mm-hmm. my friends, my close friends, my daughter. My daughter, she's brilliant. She's dynamic.
Imagine.
She's doing some great
things. I bet she has a daddy that touches the top of her head without her asking.
Yeah, and she takes advantage of that, you know. And we have our challenges. I mean, she's a teenager trying to do her thing, but
But it's her name.
Nandi.
Nandi.
And this is a poem I wrote for Nandi when she was 14. It's called 10 Reasons Why Fathers Cry at Night. One, because 14-year-olds don't like park swings or long walks anymore unless you're in the mall. Two, because holding her hand is forbidden and kisses are lethal. Three, because school was fine, her day was fine, and yes, she's fine. So why is she weeping? Four, because you want to help, but you can't read minds. Five, because she's in love, and that's cute, until you find his note asking her to prove it. Six, because she doesn't prove it. Seven, because next week she's in love again, and this time it's real. She says her heart is heavy. Eight, because she yearns to take long walks in the park with him. Nine, because you remember the myriad woes and wonders of spring desire. And 10, because with trepidation and thrill, you watch your daughter who suddenly wants to swing all by herself.
Kwame Alexander, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. I was wondering what made you happy when you wrote, but I don't have to ask again because I know I heard it. How many versions are there to a poem before you finish it?
Oh, that's so funny. I remember... I was talking to Naomi Shihab Nye, and she said she's still revising poems she's written 20 and 30 years ago.
So, is it a mistake to put them out too soon?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it can be a mistake to put it out too soon, but when is too soon? I think you determine that for yourself. But there are certainly poems that I've kind of, that are published, that I'm still tweaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a few that I like to make a little bit different or a little better.
Do you have a poem that you absolutely love, or do you love them all?
I love them all.
Mm-hmm.
There is one that kind of speaks to me. Yeah, there's a couple that kind of speak to me.
Well, I know that before we leave, we'll hear your favorite poem. But if you were to describe yourself as an artist of conscience, what would you think that meant?
An artist of conscience. Someone who gives great deal of thought and caring to the words. And not just to the arrangement of the words, but to what's being said. You know, I believe it's the poet's job to be honest, to be authentic, and to offer something that's going to change the way someone sees the world.
Does it happen?
I think so. I think so, even if it's for that moment.
Do we have good people in Washington?
Yeah, there's you. There's me. But you know, there are certainly good people. There are good people everywhere. But we got some pretty crazy people, too.
We have hundreds of good poets in Washington. People don't believe me.
Oh, yeah.
I would say 500. How long have you lived here?
91.
Where did you come from?
Virginia Tech.
Oh,
as soon as I graduated,
but you weren't
I came
born
here. No, I was born in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah.
One more question about your career. Mm-hmm. How do you get these gigs all over the country where you go in and teach young people in workshops? Do they know of you in word of mouth? You get invitations from school to school?
Yeah,
is that how it happens?
Yep, word of mouth. And I speak at a lot of conferences. And so by the time this airs, I will have presented at the National Council for Teachers of English, which there'll be thousands and thousands of English teachers from around
what
the country.
What will you present?
I'll be talking about this new concept, Poetry 2.0, the power of poetry.
Have you written it already?
I've drafted it, and I'll be kind of revising it tonight.
What does 2.0 mean?
Poetry 2.0. It's the power of poetry to connect our students to their past, to their present, to their future.
You don't think that's being done in the high schools?
No. I mean, certainly we have poetry. Certainly there's poetry in the schools, whether it's Shakespeare or in some classes, it may be even as progressive as spoken word. But I think when we allow the children to be able to express themselves, to talk about what's on their mind, and to be able to do it in a haiku or free verse, to be able to put things in context like love. I am not a painter. Browns and blues, we get along, but we are not close. I am no Van Gogh, but give me plain paper, a dull pencil, some scotch, and I will hijack your curves. Take your soul hostage. Paint a portrait so colorful and delicate, you just may have to cut off my ear.
Let's hear another poem after that. Kwame Alexander.
This is one of my favorite poems. And this is a poem I wrote after going to one too many open mics.
Could that be?
Yeah, it's a longer poem. I'm not sure how much time we actually have left.
How many pages is it?
It's two.
That's good.
It's called Dancing Naked on the Floor. Write a poem with tension, like some Baptist church split. Let it walk a tightrope between Congregation 1 and Congregation 2. Write a poem that finishes school, a magna cum laude poem. Let it be momentous. Learn something meaningful. Share something significant. Write a poem that looks good, a Billie Holiday poem. Not homely or swayback. Give it posture, poise, and profile. Turn our heads when it walks by. Stomp our feet when it smiles. On some superficial level, make us want to marry it. Or at least remember its name the next morning. Write a poem that works. Write a poem that works, has a job and does it promptly, follows rules and responsibilities, gets a raise or at least a head nod. And when it's not feeling well, when your poem ain't feeling well, give it sense enough to call in sick and not waste our time with unmet expectations. Write a poem that has a family, not some single life of soiled one-night stands. I mean, your poem should be in a serious relationship. Let it commit to something. Move beyond soap opera sex. Let it be passionate. And if it gets excited, if your poem has to get physical, let it be in the privacy of its own beautiful mind, because we can watch cable at home. Write a poem that travels, gets outside your cramped apartment, leaves all that tired baggage, and catches a plane somewhere. Takes us on a journey, fueled by imagination and study, not television and film. Write a poem that's been somewhere we haven't. Write a poem that reads, please. Write a poem that reads more than headlines and sitcom credits. A cultured poem. Write a poem that knows how to talk, not some misbehaving foul mouth looking for attention. An eloquent poem. Write a poem that dances, wild and free. A gutsy poem. Write a poem that cooks. I mean, it ain't got to bake a cake, but at least let it know the ingredients. Write a poem that exercises. Cycling is not required, but steps never hurt nobody. Write a poem that runs for office. It ain't got to win, but at least campaign. Get a clue, poets. Write a poem with an inkling of suspicion. I mean, it ain't got to solve a crime, but at least let it offer us a tip. Write a poem that is contagious. Write a poem that is contagious. Write a poem that is contagious, Grace. Let it inspire, make us want to write a poem about how beautiful and breathtaking and tragic and beautiful and breathtaking and tragic and hopeful life is.
That is the voice of Kwame Alexander, the inimitable voice of Kwame Alexander. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we will be right back. We're back. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Peter Clappert is here, and he has been a well-known name on my bookshelf since 1971. Here's Peter.
This is a prose poem. I hope it isn't too obvious when I read it. It's called Chapter 30, and it has an epigraph, which is a question. What took you so long? Sanity, rational philosophy, walking upright, the ice on the driveway, vertigo, the broken strut, and the way we had to shoot the animals. Inevitably, a glacier. Finding the crampons, losing the matches, frozen K rations, and the Russian jeep. Explosions at dawn and at evening. Questions at headquarters, Madame Lachaise and the tea ritual. Circular stairs, distress in the mirrors, the zeros, the ampersands, tunnel vision. Later that day, the German tourist who translated for us. Glass on the highway, headlights and taillights, the loss of the verb, the concept of distance, one country disappearing into another. And always, on a radio, in an empty square, the old song, memory winding down like a clock. But finally, and really, the loss of a landscape, the loss of a motive, the night nurse, the graveyard shift, rational, philosophy.
The voice of Peter Clapper. That is an entire film noir, an entire film.
Can I tell you something about it?
Please.
I always think of Afghanistan when I read this poem. I went to Afghanistan because my folks were living there right after I graduated from college. And in fact, my father and I made a trip to Bamiyan, and I stood on top of the great Buddha of Bamiyan, which now, of course, is rubble, thanks to the Taliban. We went in a Russian jeep. So frozen K rations in a Russian jeep. We didn't have any K rations. And we were just talking. We're going down this windy road, not another person, let alone another vehicle in sight. And someone had just said, isn't it remarkable how you see German tourists everywhere? And we rounded a corner in this gorge, and by God, there was a Mercedes pulled over to the side of the road.
Well, the reason I put you in another era, because you know so much about European history and you write so much about the era. I thought that was World War II.
Well, it's in a funny sense, it's sort of supposed to be timeless.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's so austere and it's so bleak and it is so much is said about war without full frontal nudity, you know what I mean?
Yes.
The way you enter that poem, Peter, has made you distinguished in the world. And I'm going to start with the time I discovered you before I knew you. And it was through a book called Lugging Vegetables to Nantucket, Yale Series of Younger Poets, which is about the best award you can win as a young person. It is the catapult, which says you are the one. Since then, you have 5 other collections, The Idiot Princess of the Last Dynasty. I remember the pain you went through with that one. And that is now to be reprinted by Carnegie Mellon. Very good. Choke Cherries, New and Selected Poems. And that was 2000. You've taught at Rollins at Winter mm-hmm. Park, Florida, Harvard, New College, Florida. Oh, that's a cool place. And the College of William and Mary and the Graduate Writing Program of George Mason University, where I think you're emeritus.
No, I'm not emeritus yet, but you're on the right track. I'm on leave at the moment.
Oh, I thought you retired.
I will be officially retired at the end of May.
Ah, how does it feel?
Wonderful. Really wonderful.
After how many years at George Mason?
29 or 30. I think you do anything too long, it gets tiring.
All those words, Peter. Did you say anything?
Did I?
Say anything all those years? Do you think you said anything to those students?
I think so. One of the most gratifying parts of teaching were the letters that I still get from former students.
Peter Clapper.
And the successes, you know, the people have gone on to publish.
Do they attribute it to you ever?
I get thanked in a couple of acknowledgments pages, but that's not important. It's knowing that you were useful.
He's done a lot of groundbreaking work in the world also at WPA, and we'll talk a little bit about his work as an essayist and critic. As a poet, I don't think you would shy away from the fact that people marvel at your versatility and your technique. Technique is not a dirty word. What do you think it means?
Technique?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's doing the work of being a poet.
Knowing your stuff?
Knowing your stuff. I mean, it's not inevitable. You can have great visual painters who are terrible at figure drawing. You can have wonderful poets like William Carlos Williams, who wrote horrible rhymed metered poems before he started.
And Patterson wasn't all that good either.
Well, I think parts of Patterson are terrific, but you're right. But in general, I think people should learn to play chopsticks before they go into a concert hall and give a concert.
And you can. You can. Peter Clafford, we're at the Library of Congress. If I asked you what you thought rhetoric was in your poetry, would you know the answer?
Rhetoric. I hope there isn't a lot of rhetoric in the poetry as I use the term.
Oh, you think that rhetoric is a rant?
Well, there are, of course, there some English departments are called Department of Rhetoric, and that's not the sense in which the word rings for me. When I hear it, what I hear is bombast. And,
I hear tone and diction.
Okay, good. That's a much more sophisticated sense of the word.
Do you know what your tone and diction are? If you died and we had a seminar on you, would you know what they might say about you?
I hope they'd have a very hard time generalizing.
Good answer. So give us a poem to prove it. Peter Clapper.
You know, facility and technical ability are not the same thing.
Ah.
And the technical qualities are the product of quite a lot of work. I'm going to read a poem which is sometimes called a villanelle. It looks like a villanelle. And in fact, it was written on assignment when I was in graduate school, and the assignment was to write a villanelle. But this one is not. Villanelle, for those who don't know, is a very difficult verse form invented by the troubadour poets. Nobody devotes their life to writing villanelles, but many poets want to write at least a couple of good ones.
You know, that's a great line. Nobody devotes their life to writing villanelles. That says it all.
Part of the villanelle is a pattern of repetition of lines. But in this poem, the first nine lines repeat as the second nine lines, but in a different order. So that's not villanelle-like. It's called Ellie Mae Leaves in a Hurry. There's some who say she put death up her dress, and some who say they saw her pour it down. It's not the sort of thing you want to press, so we just assumed she planned on leaving town and gave her money for the first express. She had some family up in Puget Sound. Well, we are married men. We've got interests. You can't take children out like cats to drown. It's not the sort of thing you want to press. We didn't know she'd go and pour death down, though most of us had heard of her distress. We just assumed she planned on leaving town. There's some of us who put death up her dress, but she had family up in Puget Sound. Mm. We gave her money for the first express. Hmm. Well, we are married men. We've got interests, though most of us had heard of her distress. You can't take children out like cats to drown. It's just the sort of news that gets around.
I'm telling you, Peter, that is a work of art. Do you know what a work of art is?
A work of art?
I don't, but I know that
I would not attempt to define it.
How about unity? How about symmetry? How about beauty? How about death up her dress? What a line!
Well, you know, I was listening to your conversation with Kwame, and I'm in complete agreement with him. I mean, a poem should be reflect both a combination of thinking and emotion, feeling, which goes way back to the start of the 20th century. Ezra Pound's An Image is an Intellectual and Emotional Complex in an Instant of Time.
What
or,
a piece
or
of work.
Or William Carlos Williams' No Ideas But in Things.
How many hours was that poem in the making?
I don't know. I didn't hand it in on time.
You didn't have gray hair when you began it, though, did you?
I didn't hand it in on time, and I wrote it was in a notebook, and I went on to another notebook, and sometime later I just started turning pages in the old notebook, to see if they were
lines. Was it easy?
Good lines I'd left behind her. And there it was, all finished.
Was it easy or hard?
What was?
The whole writing of that poem.
That's a hard question. So long ago.
I think form is... mine comes out like a person wearing shoes that are too big. I clunk a lot, and that doesn't have one clunk.
Well, I also like light verse.
Well, let us continue with more of your work and tell the world who you are overall. Peter Clappert has done some very innovative things in the world in addition to writing essays and poems. And he formed, I believe, the first conference at the Associated Writing Programs on gay writing, gay, lesbian, bisexual writing, and you had some august panelists, and that was the first of its kind, and after that you wrote an essay about it. What do you remember? Can you just crystallize what you said in that essay in one sentence?
Well, none of the panelists in the panel on the gay/lesbian writer in context, none of them addressed the situation in teaching. And the title had a colon, and then it said, I don't know, the academy, the literary community, the marketplace. And people talked about the difficulty of publishing explicitly gay work, which at some time was very difficult, though not true now. Mm-hmm. And people talked about being in a community of writers who are mostly straight when you know that you're not. But nobody addressed the question of academia. So that was what my essay, my contribution
was. What a venturesome
thing. And I took a title from Jean Anouilh. It's from Mademoiselle Colombe, a play. And a character says, "Couldn't I love you and also want to go dancing?"
Oh, you have a way of finding these quaint titles and lines. But the point I want to make is this was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And that was... quite a thing to do. Peter Clappert's here at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and here's his poetry.
Well, you know, I don't have very many poems that are explicitly on gay themes.
No, you don't.
And there are some in the book I've been working on my whole life and probably will never finish, Scattering Carl. But I think I'm not going to read one of those. I would like to read a poem that started with its last line. And in fact, I like the last line so much I used it twice. People make a lot of fun of gays, and people make a lot of fun of morticians. And I thought, well, what about two gay morticians who are partners? So this is called The Courtship of the Morticians, and it's in two sections. Nothing human or inhuman revulses them. After the formaldehyde, the lanoflow and powder, after roses and chrysanthemums and gladioluses, after a cozy soprano in the dolorous chapel, or folding chairs and accordion under elms and weeping cherries, after tea and cakes and marmalade and little cookies brought in upon a platter, after laying a few long greens tenderly across the sexton's pink calluses, leaving Forest Lawn and heading back to the glassy mortuary, they park for almost an hour at the end of a dirt road in an untamed part of the cemetery. Their eyes reflect a minor entanglement of convolvuluses, reflect bindweed and dodder and railroad vine, and the small red morning glories, which are closed now because it is late afternoon. They sit close together on the silver-gray banquette. They do not force the moment to a crisis, but they sit close together on the rayon velvet banquette, in the front row, as it were, and hold each other's pulses. The courtship of the morticians was not notably different, not better or worse, more or less passionate, histrionic, disingenuous, manipulative, tough, or tender than other courtships, except in this one small regard only. After wine and candlelight, after cocktails and inflected chatter, after the play, concert, or drive-in movie, after wine and candlelight and violins, after beer and kielbasa and accordions, they parked in the cemetery with the other compulsives and held each other's pulses.
I knew exactly which was your line. When I heard holding each other's pulses, yep. I thought, bingo. And
the only time
you used it again.
It's the only time a poem has started with its last line for me.
You have a devilishly fiendish love. Such a mischievous person you are.
But well,
when you put it in elegant, timeless, perfect meter and rhyme, something happens.
You know, we're recording this here on Capitol Hill, and it seems like I ought to be reading something a little political. So I'd like to read a section from a very strange book. We didn't include it in the selected poems because of its format. It's called 52 Pickup, Scenes from the Conspiracy, a Documentary. And it's a form in the it's a poem in the form of a documentary film script. A lot of documentary film scripts are in two columns, sound and picture. But this is a script for a documentary that couldn't be filmed with a soundtrack, for the most part, that couldn't be recorded. It's a documentary that can only be made up in the reader's imagination. The strange thing about that is my good friend, the painter Sheba Sharrow, liked it so much that she went out and got a grant to put it on stage as a multimedia performance piece.
How
well,
was
that,
it?
That was a real challenge to
was
find a way to translate this. Yes, it worked very well. But the basic premise of the book is that old saying, it's all a conspiracy. And I thought, what if it is all a conspiracy? The creation of the universe, the evolution of life, birth, marriage, education, rise to political power. So this traces a creature called the conspiracy through a couple of lifetimes, actually, because the conspiracy is assassinated and reincarnated, assassinated by the conspiracy, and then its reincarnation is again the conspiracy. But, you know, every 4 years we have this orgy of politicking running up to the presidential election, and it's already beginning. And when we have that, there are usually documentaries about the candidate's life. And they go back to his hometown and they talk to people who knew him as a child. So this is that section. A visit to the dome of our next teapot. Double-jointedness as a child, recalled by Mrs. Maple, first grade teacher. Mrs. Maple. He was a quiet child. He was a quiet, well-behaved child. He was a thoughtful child who liked to read books. He was a quiet, well-manicured, thoughtful child who liked nothing so much as to curl up with a good book. He was a well-behaved, well-manicured child who liked to curl up quietly with a book. He was so quiet, we thought he was dim. He was a quiet oral Sunday, and may the best church win.
Oh, Peter, did you have fun doing that?
Yeah, and you know what Mrs. Maple says is based on lines in a number of actual campaign biographies.
Peter Clapper, the independent intellectual. That's
all,
who you
all,
are.
All presidential candidates seem to have been quiet children who like to read.
Well-manicured.
And well-mannered, yes.
I have never seen this book, and I have to look through it. May I ask about the picture on the back?
The picture of the author?
Yes, the picture of the author. I see a two-year-old in diapers and boots and an army hat. Could that be Vu?
Yes, it is me. It was taken by my father, who was a professional photographer.
Oh, tell us about that. I love that line you said before we went on tape, that you had so many lights on you and he took so many pictures.
Yeah, I have an aversion to being photographed because when I was quite small and he had nothing else to do, he would sit me in front of his spotlights, and they were professional spotlights, they were very strong, and take pictures of me. Now, I think in memory I probably exaggerate this, but I still have a discomfort when somebody points a camera at me.
But you said he took pictures of me until I cried.
Until I cried, yep.
This is Peter Clapper, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress acting up in poetry. Here's another poem.
Yeah, I think I'll read a poem related to that. He was Newsday's first photographer on Long Island. Alicia Patterson hired him, and a friend of his, Ed Buckley, were the first photographers for Newsday.
You grew up on Long Island in
Connecticut. On Long Island, yeah, mm-hmm. West Hempstead.
That was pretty fancy.
In those days, it was almost rural.
Oh.
There was a farm across the street, very few houses around us. We were on a 1 acre pond that we owned. And by the time we left, the farm had become a junior, senior high school and a housing development. And now the pond has been filled in and they've put three or four houses there. Anyway, this is a birth announcement. Notice. Arrived November 1942, after 2 days indecision with other dispatches. No one noted time of day or weather. Mother in agony, start of winter. Issued 1 column inch out of courtesy to father, crime photographer, in company with masked insanity. Hitler wrote the headlines, and P joined humanity.
P. Now, I've just read Reed Whitmore's memoir, and he refers to himself as R throughout the book. Hmm. And is this customary? And you referred to yourself as P.
No, no.
Have
at
I
all.
Missed something? Oh,
no.
Okay. I
wonder. But I signed
was...
my emails P.
Well, that's true. I just want to know if it was a
this
job.
This was written long before that. I hate to admit it. This is very closely based on a poem written in graduate school.
It's very concise as a birth announcement.
When I was putting the selected poems together, I just decided to go back through old stuff and see if there was anything left behind that I wanted to keep. And so that was one of the things.
Did you feel that winning the Yale series launched you? How did that help you and how did it hinder you?
Oh, there's no question about it. And, you know, I'm always telling my students who enter contests, whether individual poems or book contests, that it's all a throw of the dice. If anybody but Stanley Kunitz had been the judge of the Yale series, I probably wouldn't have been selected.
How did it help you?
This very same year, the same manuscript came back from Pittsburgh with a standard rejection letter. Stanley had set himself, when he took over as judge, the task of selecting markedly different books, different kinds of poetry each year. So I guess my number came up at the right moment.
How did it, do you think it hurt you in any way along the way? Jealousy, rivalry, competition, anything negative?
Well, I did get a couple of letters from former classmates that said, if you read between the lines, they said, "How did this happen? We didn't think you knew anybody."
Amen. Here's Peter.
And in fact,
Trevor.
I didn't know Stanley Kunitz. I had barely read him at the time I won.
Peter Clappert is here at the Library of Congress, and he is a whole force in poetry, editing, writing, teaching for some 35 years. And his new work is even more surprising and more innovative than I thought possible.
Yeah, I would like to read what I call a simultaneous poem. It's a poem that has two lines of discourse going on, and they mix together. This is based on an incident in unpublished manuscript by a friend of mine, T. Hunter Wilson. He was a conscientious objector and did his alternate service in Laos. And he was walking through the small city of Savannakhet, and he saw a guy panhandling on a corner. He was obviously a farmer. He obviously didn't belong in the city. So T, being the kind of person he was, certainly reached into his pocket for some change, but he also wanted to know the man's story. And the man said, "Well, I'm a farmer in Dong Hain, which is a small village about 60 kilometers away. And when the soldiers came, we had to leave." He had sent his family down by bus, which had taken his life savings. And then he had walked down. So T asks him, "Well, what will you do now?" He said, "Well, when the soldiers leave, we'll go back." And there's a... must have been a look of some astonishment on T's face at the confidence with which he said that. And he said, "As a matter of fact, I've sent my son back to see if he can find our water buffalo." And the son was probably 8 or 10 years old. Well, like me, T was startled at the idea of a kid like that walking through 60 kilometers of jungle infested with soldiers. And again, the old man said, "Oh, no, he is very young, and no one will want to harm him." And that just stayed with me. The poem itself is in the form of one long sentence, but the sentence is interrupted by a series of if clauses. There's no then clause. "Boy walking back to find his father's cattle. He is very young, and no one will want to harm him." Through a kingdom of spirits in air, through an army in shadows, if the road through the jungle is muddy. The small boy walking back to Donghain, to the clear, familial light. If the flame trees are blooming, if he sleeps for a night in a wat, in that land below language, to find his father's cattle. Stops now for tea or a basket of glutinous rice, or stops only to look at his feet. If the water jar has been broken, if a river is rising, and starts again walking, if he finds the five buffalo. Now back to Savan from his village unsettled in ashes, a place, if the T-28s remain grounded, if rifles doze in the sun, in the mind of his father, who would, were it safe, walk back himself if his ancestral spirits are there and are kind, with his son to Donghain, where he farms in the past, if he is very young, and no one will want to harm him, through a forest of soldiers.
That is the voice of Peter Clabbard. I thought here as I heard that, how some poets write about the world and bring it inward to the heart. Peter literally creates the world from his heart. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Peter Clabbard has been our poet. I am just sitting here still a little bit under the spell of that poem. This program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. This program is funded by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry with assistance and support from the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Michael Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.